Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Well, welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast with over 6 million unique listeners in 180 countries. I'm JP Nichols. On last week's show, we had a very robust discussion on Libra, the new virtual currency announced by Facebook. Today, we're going to take that conversation a little bit broader, and we're going to look at the future of virtual currencies and cryptocurrencies, which Libra either is or is not, depending on who you ask and what definition you want to use. But what are the next moves for governments, central banks, and regulators? Where does Bitcoin go from here? What does this mean for other cryptocurrencies? What about banks and credit unions? And what about consumers? My guests today are Rumi Morales, a partner at Outlier Ventures, where she cultivates and invests in emerging technologies that will define our economy's next generation, along with Dara Tarkowski, an experienced legal professional, advocate, entrepreneur, speaker, and writer who's passionate about disrupting traditional models and innovating at the intersections of law, financial services, and technology. Well, first, we just have one conference announcement. If you're looking for ways to create new sources of value for your bank or credit union, or if you've been tasked with building or managing an innovation team within your organization, you really need to attend the BAI Innovation Summit, October 8th through 10th in Boston. Innovation isn't chasing shiny new technologies, it's about creating value. Jason Hendricks and I will be conducting an interactive, hands-on session that will take you through an empirical approach to value creation designed to maximize results and minimize wasted efforts. We'll start with a series of strategic frameworks and lenses to help you pursue innovative ideas that are highly aligned with your strategic priorities. The result is a portfolio approach that balances the need to incrementally improve the existing business while creating viable new options for the future. Find more information and register at BAI.org. And now you can save $300 if you use code S19. That's S like Sierra, 19, at BAI.org. Well, Dara Tarkowski, welcome back to the show. You are an attorney with a unique focus on fintech. And I don't want to repeat last week's show, but I think it makes sense to start with Libra. What are your initial thoughts about this as a lawyer? First of all, do you think it meets the legal definitions as a cryptocurrency? And what are your thoughts in general?
Thank you so much for having me back on the show, JP. I always chuckle when I'm asked questions about is this coin, is that coin, is this medium, that meeting. Meeting the legal definition of cryptocurrency, because the true answer to that lies in who it is that you're asking about what the legal definition of crypto is. Are you talking to FinCEN? Are you talking to the SEC? Are you talking to the CFTC? I suppose if we're talking about whether or not we're going to call Libra a decentralized system based on blockchain, we've got the based on blockchain part covered. I think that there's open debate about the decentralization part of it. But if we're looking at kind of the way FinCEN early defined virtual currency, you know, as quote, a medium of exchange while lacking legal tender status, but it has the equivalent value in real currency or can act as a substitute for real currency, it probably does hit that FinCEN standard. And then as a result, will likely be subject to what I would assume are all of the associated BSA and FinCEN regulations. Generally, I think Libra is a truly fascinating topic. I think it sparked a lot of both technical and philosophical debate about what the future of virtual currency is. And what it should be, where the power should lie, is this safe? So I think the questions that the whole Facebook's white paper has really prompted is great discourse. And I think there's room for a lot of both academic and philosophical viewpoints on it.
So do you think it moves forward pretty close to the way it's outlined in the existing white paper, or do you think there will need to be quite a few changes before it's actually launched live?
I think that there is still a good amount of work to be done. I think that the white paper, while it goes through, I think, kind of high level, I would say aspirational, what it likes to be. I think that there is always going to be certainly kinks worked out in true implementation. And then truth be told, it's funny, I hosted a debate watch party for the first set of 2020 presidential candidates. And I think given the politicization of data privacy, personal information, and I think Libra and what Facebook is trying to do right now is actually going to become a really, really politicized issue. And I would actually expect to see a lot more conversation about it in the U.S., certainly here in Washington, about how it's going to be regulated ultimately. And I don't think that a nonprofit association, as they've outlined it before, frankly, depending on how the election goes, is going to be sufficient for lawmakers in the United States.
So I spent last night instead watching USA versus Panama in Gold Cup soccer action. So I did not watch the Democratic debate round one. Did any of them talk about Libra or cryptocurrency or blockchain at all?
Not about Libra, cryptocurrency, or blockchain specifically, but I think those are natural topics that come out of privacy discussions. And they are going to be there was, however, lots of discussion about the amount of power that large corporations continue to garner. And you know, Facebook has been the crosshairs of Washington, and you know, there's been testimony before Congress, and I think that given the security concerns and the privacy concerns that lawmakers have very, very vocally and publicly expressed vis-a-vis Facebook, this is going to be like the natural next step. Like the amount of information that the organization has on billions and billions of people is massive, and no one's going to really kind of contest or debate that. And now you're adding a whole new layer of information to that. And I think that Facebook, from a privacy standpoint and a security standpoint, is still in a period of rebuilding public trust. So, I mean, to me, this is, I think, a daring and bold step. I'm not, you know, forming an opinion on whether or not it's necessarily a bad one. But I do think that it will prompt certainly questions about, you know, the safety and safekeeping of not only people's personal information, but now financial information about exactly how they spend their money and what they spend their money on and who they're sending it to and the times of days that they're, you know, that they're spending. And it's, you know, it's the information is powerful. And it's, you know, I would put a large sum betting on the fact that, you know, these issues will become more front and center. You know, last night's debate was just an introduction to a few of the candidates, but the topic of, you know, privacy and power at the highest corporate levels was certainly raised. And I expect, as you know, the field whittles down, especially if for certain front runners, that topic is very, very high on the priority list. So I'd expect more.
Well, I want to come back to that, but I want to bring Rumi Morales into the conversation. Rumi, you were an early specialist in digital currency, blockchain, and distributed ledger technologies. And you were previously mm-hmm. head of CME Ventures at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Welcome back to the show. But
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Tell us, first of all, I'll ask you the same question where I started with Dara, is that do you think that Libra is a cryptocurrency? What are your thoughts in general?
You know, I read someone calling it a corpo currency the other day. I thought that was kind of funny as a corporate currency. I've never been one to, and this is where I'm not a lawyer like Dara, but I've never been one to get too hung up over semantics. For me, is it a representation of a store of value digitally? Yes. So does that qualify as a cryptocurrency? Let's say yes, but I mean, obviously there's so many different variations of what a cryptocurrency can be, you know, whether it is as a payment mechanism or it's a representation of someone's self-sovereign identity, right? Whether it's a method for machines to be able to communicate with each other, that can all fall under, for me, the general umbrella of what you can call a crypto asset at the very least.
So I want to take a quick minute to thank our show sponsor, Molekule, the makers of an incredible new air filtration technology that's designed for the home and office. It's capable of destroying air pollutants at the molecular level. For our listeners today, we have a unique promo code, and it's our favorite word, FinTech, which will give you $75 off your first order. Just visit molekule.com, that's with a K, M-O-L-E-K-U-L-E.com, and enter the promo code FinTech. That's molekule.com with a K, and use promo code FinTech. Well, Rumi, certainly Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency, and it's enjoyed quite a bit of a resurgence lately. It's back up over $13,000, near 18-month highs. Do you think that has anything to do with the Libra announcement?
It's possible. I mean, as you saw, though, it's surging all over the place, and some people are considering whether this is indeed a bull run or just a blip for now. But I think overall, the Libra announcement has been very helpful to continue to spread general awareness, especially amongst larger institutions and the public, about what a digital currency can do. And it just making people feel a little bit more comfortable. Like, it wasn't too long ago where I would tell my dad that I was involved in Bitcoin, and he looked very concerned for my safety. Didn't want the police come knocking on the door, because that was his awareness of it. It's totally changed now, and I think that the Facebook announcement has helped that. So to the extent that we might have new retail investors getting into Bitcoin post the Facebook announcement because they feel more comfortable with it, I think, yeah, there is possibly a correlation.
Well, yeah, and that advice changes. I was also told don't get into a car with strangers, and I take a lot of Uber rides.
Ubers, right? Yeah.
Right. Well, I've shared on the show before, my favorite quote about cryptocurrency is from one of the regulators I was talking to in Hong Kong. He says, the crypto part is super interesting. It's the currency part we haven't figured out yet. And Libra's value is pegged to a basket of currencies, which makes it a form of a stable coin. And it solves for the price volatility that's either a feature or a bug to cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, depending on how you look at it. How do you think Libra will succeed in finally becoming a true ubiquitous global currency? And Dara, I'll start with you.
Well, you know, I think this a little bit goes back to, you know, some of the comments that I made before. Much of it, I believe, will depend on right now as it's envisioned and designed, it is going to be pegged to that basket of currencies. There is going to be reserve set. There is going to be ways for, you know, individuals to be able to cash out. And, you know, that is really going to become that central authority. I think depending on any issues that are seen with that kind of central authority will really depend on whether or not the regulators allow that to exist in its current, as it's currently envisioned to be comprised. That really may or may not be the case. And I think especially in the wake of some of the guidance that was issued by the Financial Action Task Force just a day or so ago, it is going to be very impactful to see how all of the international regulators, the U.S. regulators, in my view, in particular, how they're going to view that with all of the traditional BSA and AML processes that need to be put in place. So I think, like everything, no one knows how to get in the way of a good idea like a lawyer or a lawmaker. But depending on if the regulators can get on board and get comfortable with the way those transactions are taking place, and whether or not the way those transactions end up working are consistent with the FATF guidance, then the answer is it could be. And if not, then there's going to be a lot more work to be done.
Well, Rumi, what do you think?
Yeah, I definitely agree that the regulation around this remains a huge unknown in terms of whether this can become, as you put it, a true ubiquitous global currency. And also, let's not forget a big part of the globe that's not on Facebook, China, which will keep, I think, Libra from being a great global currency, especially considering that WeChat is already kind of like that Facebook within China itself.
Right.
They kind of
have
that.
They're already doing a lot of this.
They're already doing it. So maybe Facebook and Libra will be the WeChat for the rest of the world. But that's still assuming a lot. It's going to assume that people are connected enough via Facebook that a payment platform utilizing Facebook's networks and those of its partners makes sense. It's assuming that people will want to participate, mixing their financial data alongside their social data. It's presuming that people are not, that the trend is towards greater trust in Facebook. And everything that I've seen, at least in the United States around the news with Facebook, suggests that is not the trend. And that people become a little bit leery of utilizing Facebook to be able to take over more of their data in their lives, unless somehow individuals can be assured that the data that they have and that they're sharing on Facebook is ultimately theirs and it's portable. And should they choose to, maybe if they go to China, they can bring their Facebook payment information over and use it in WeChat instead. That's not the case. But I think this is, again, the power of the purest cryptocurrency over Facebook currency is we're not dealing with a walled garden when it comes to Bitcoin. You know, Facebook Libra is the AOL for the internet. There was a time when all of us thought that in order to access the internet, we needed to subscribe to AOL. Very similarly, there could be a time when people feel like, oh, to use digital currency, I'll use Facebook. But as we know, the real power of cryptocurrencies writ large is their open, borderless nature.
Well, do you see that? So playing on that analogy, and we talked about that on last week's show as well, AOL was the gateway to the internet for lots and lots of people. And at least this time, they don't have to mail me any CD-ROMs in the mail or include them in my magazine subscription.
Or you have like the modem sound like, sure, right in the background as you're trying to,
Log
on for the first time.
Yeah, I sure hope that isn't the future of digital currency, but will this be a gateway for others? So, I mean, you bring up a number of good points. There are some hurdles. This certainly wasn't the world's first stable coin. Parts of the world and many people around the world are not on Facebook, but will this be a gateway for others?
I think it could very well be. Just, you know, if you think about MySpace and why being a gateway to Facebook, I do see it as a stepping stone for greater ubiquity of people feeling comfortable with digital payments. But again, this is assuming, and I really personally, just like Dara, I tend to focus on the regulatory issue around this a lot. You know, the headlines as they're written and as some lawmakers grasped onto them, I think not incorrectly, is that Facebook is printing its own money here. You know, can they do that? And I was kind of bemused by it again because, and I guess this goes back to your original question of is Facebook a cryptocurrency? The simple fact that they can point to a central organization as responsible for this is interesting because obviously with Bitcoin there is no central organization that you can point to. But you know, to that end, people do feel kind of more comfortable with centralization. It could be a very good stepping stone, but I do not think this is, this is the promised land that we're going to walk towards. It's one stone towards it.
Right. No centralization, again, either a feature or a bug, depending on how you look at it. But let's build on that and talk about what you mentioned earlier, the cryptocurrency. The Libra Association calls themselves an independent, not-for-profit membership organization headquartered in Geneva, Switzerland. But its membership is comprised of not only Facebook, but payment companies like Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, and Stripe, technology companies like eBay, Spotify, Uber, and Lyft, technology or telecommunication companies like Vodafone, plus blockchain and venture capital firms. As Brian Rombley said in last week's show, it's the diametric opposite of Bitcoin, and that's pretty much what you just said, too. So I can't wait to hear all the people say, I don't trust the central bank, but I trust Facebook and this group of technology companies to be in charge of a global currency. I mean, how does this play out, do you think?
Just my opinion, I think those people who are saying, I don't trust a central bank are also the same ones that would say, I don't trust these 27 members.
Right.
I think it's the people that would like the 27 members are your general Facebook users. Again, not to throw my father under the bus once more, but you know, he is now a very active Facebook user. And I think someone like him may find it convenient. He's not going to pull out Venmo. He doesn't use PayPal. But maybe we're at out to dinner and I'll say, oh, dad, I don't have, you know, can you cover for me? He's like, oh, I'll just use my Facebook, right? I mean, and for him, having names like PayPal and Visa is very important. But I don't think it's the same collection of people that are trying to go, you know, bring the central banks down. So there's a, I think there's a universe for whom this would be helpful. But I know for more and more people who are concerned about data privacy and data protection, these names are a reason to pause. Now, I think, though, if you think about Libra and Facebook as a business, obviously having these names are important because, you know, not only is the Libra value pegged to the basket of currencies from the stablecoin, like you said, but, you know, just this the simple fact that you have a group of people like this ensuring that you can use these current networks, that these networks already exist, it does a lot to be able to make sure that this quote-unquote currency has greater network adoption to begin with. And that's a real challenge for many, you know, quote, altcoins that are trying to gain adoption is just having enough supply and demand.
Yeah, Dara, this pegging the value to a basket of currencies, what does that do to the complexity of the regulatory needs and compliance for something like Libra?
Well, you know, I think I would pull it back to, you know, the FATF is an independent intergovernmental body that applies not just in the United States, but to, you know, the entire global system. What I actually find...
Can you expound on that just a moment? Can you explain how that works?
Sure.
At a high level.
Yeah, high level, the Financial Action Task Force, FATF, is an independent intergovernmental body that develops and promotes basically policies to protect the global financial system against money laundering, terrorist financing, and the financing and proliferation of basically weapons of mass destruction. The FATF recommendations are recognized basically as the global AML and counter-terrorist financing standard, and regulatory bodies across the planet. Basically, that is the standard. And then every single government can essentially adopt the guidance and proliferate the guidance in their own way and consistent with their own sets of statutes, rules, and regulations. But the guidance is designed to, you know, protect the world. So they expect that the regulators around the world are going to embrace that purpose and essentially adopt guidance. And the guidance is only that, it's guidance. They're policies, their perspectives, they are research-based, and then every single regulator basically can enact specific rules and regs within their own legal framework to make sure that the rules are applying with the same purpose to everybody.
Let me ask you though, Dara, with this being the, you know, group of the most powerful and the richest companies on earth, are they going to be bound by this? Are they going to influence regulations, or are they really going to be subject to the same rules as everybody else?
Well, if you ask Elizabeth Warren, they certainly ought to be. but you know, the Libra Association, as it's described in the white paper, actually provides, in my view, very few details about how the association will work, right? It currently has 28 members. That number is expected to rise. All of these members have to put money into the reserve, which basically enables the creation and circulation. And the amount of accountability that this association will have is going to be a direct result of how regulators around the world end up viewing how they are managing their business.
And none of them are financial institutions today.
No, they aren't. And while there are a very small number of nonprofits currently given, you know, slots, you're absolutely right. The majority of the members are very large profit-making corporations, ordinary people who will buy and use Libra, don't have any votes. And what's interesting is that I was reading a really interesting article by a professor from the University of Chicago Law School, Eric Posner, that was published in The Atlantic. And he, I think, made some really, really astute observations. Essentially, the way it's going to work, the association rather, is kind of anyone's guess. And right now, there's a very narrow kind of money transfer function that Facebook lays out in the white paper as just one possibility, right? It's narrow, and it, on its face, it appears kind of like the least threatening one. And, you know, I'm not going to, again, presume the worst. Facebook might sincerely believe, according to Professor Posner, that the association will manage Libra as he says, a kind of glorified Western Union. But he also cautions that Facebook has broken its promises before. And due to kind of the size and, you know, bottom line driven mentality of every single member organization within the association, I think that the power left to the association is quite vast. So while the first, you know, function is least threatening on its face, it could very well broaden and broaden quickly because, you know, only I think the white paper said it's a 2/3 vote for the association to, you know, kind of take any action with regards to policy. And there's just not a lot of detail about what that means in the white paper.
Yep. On that scary note, let's hit pause. I want to come back to that after break, because I think that's an important point that you make. And before we do go to break, I want to take a minute to tell you about Rhone, R-H-O-N-E, just like the river in Europe. Rhone is a men's performance lifestyle and premium activewear brand that is engineered for quality and comfort. And they're an absolute necessity for guys on the go. Sorry, ladies, this is for men. But if your busy life requires long hours in the office and long international flights, then Rhone is perfect for you. If your idea of fun is climbing the highest mountains or surfing the best waves around the world, then Rhone is perfect for you. Rhone is perfect for the gym, yoga, cross-training, biking, or any activity, really. And now Rhone has just released their amazing new commuter collection. Perfect for looking great and staying comfortable in the office or on the go. Rhone's commuter collection is the performance alternative to the everyday workwear. They have everything from pants and polos to shirts and shorts, and they're all lightweight, comfortable, and wrinkle-free. Good for anything from a weekday in the workplace to a weekend barbecue. Go to rhone.com/fintech today. You knew that word was coming, and use promo code YES. Fintech to get 20% off your first purchase. That's rhone.com/fintech and use that promo code fintech again for 20% off. rhone.com/fintech, promo code fintech. And we'll be back with more Breaking Banks right after this.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
The Voice America Live Events Channel is here now to showcase your corporate, individual, or organization's live event. Visit voiceamerica.com/live events to see all of our past live events and find out more. Whether it's a multi-day conference, special speaker, or single-day event, we've got everything to make your event a success. We can do a few hours or a few days. For more information about taking your event to the next level, call Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or email info@voiceamerica.com. Again, that's Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or send us an email to info@voiceamerica.com. Voice America is where you are and where you want to be. Join us around the globe as we broadcast live from some of the most interesting events available. Don't forget to view all our live events, including on-demand access to past events that you may have missed by visiting voiceamerica.com/live events.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Well, we have been talking about faster payments and moving money seamlessly around the world. And I want to talk about what I use to move faster and seamlessly around the world, and that's Clear. Clear helps you get through airport security with a tap of your finger so you can get to your gate faster and reduce pre-flight stress so you never have to run to your gate again. With Clear, you are your ID. Clear replaces the need for physical ID cards. You use a quick scan of your eyes or a quick tap of your fingertips, and you get through security because you're the best ID out there. It's easy to sign up. You can create your account online before going to the airport, and once you're there, a Clear ambassador will help you finish the process, and you can use Clear right then and there. Clear helps you get through security faster at more than 40 airports, but not just airports, also in stadiums across the country. With more being added every day, I use Clear to get into my Seattle Sounders games. I'll do so again this Saturday. So glad they're finally back home. They also have family plans. If you're traveling with your family, up to 3 family members can be added at a discounted rate, and kids under 18 are free when traveling with a Clear member. Clear is the absolute best way to get through airport security, and it works great with PreCheck too. So right now, our listeners can get their first 2 months of Clear for free. Go to clearme.com/fintech and use the code, wait for it, fintech. That's our favorite code here. That's C-L-E-A-R-M-E, clearme.com/fintech, and use that special code fintech for your free 2 months of Clear. Well, Derek Tarkowski, let's go back to where we were right before the break. You were saying something I think important about the 2/3 majority of the members of Libra. So what does that mean, and what concerns does that give you as an attorney?
So I don't know if my concerns are based on that of as an attorney, but, you know, I pay lots of attention to corporate governance documents. And at least the way it's outlined, you know, right now, the membership as it's comprised, as we've all kind of acknowledged, are lots of profit-making corporations, a very small number of nonprofits. And the 2/3 vote essentially means that these, you know, profit-making corporations can dictate policy decisions of the Libra Association. And it's not a secret. These companies want to make money. And the structure of the organization really gives them a direct financial interest in the management of Libra, because, again, I'm just going to give another shout out to Professor Posner from University of Chicago Law School, because I thought his article was so spot on. The investment in the reserve essentially entitles those members to dividends. As Professor Posner pointed out, that will depend on the type of asset that the reserve holds. If those assets appreciate, the members make money. And at the beginning, right, the way it's outlined in the white paper, those assets are going to be national currencies, government bonds, and those assets are, you know, not necessarily like the big giant money makers. However, there is nothing that's going to bar the association from changing the compositions of those assets if they decide they would like bigger dividends on that reserve. There's nothing going to be stopping them for, as Professor Posner pointed out in his article, exchanging some of that currency and like low risk debt for higher risk debt, making loans, buying loans from banks. Like a bank with sufficient diversification or an aggressive portfolio, like they can make a lot of money just like the big banks do. Libra will be big. There's 2.4 billion users. So to me, it's just, while the association itself is, you know, pegged as this not-for-profit group of for-profit corporations, I think it's fairly obvious from a corporate governance standpoint, like they certainly have avenues available to them to make more money should they decide to exercise those powers. And right now, there's nothing in the white paper that would stop them from doing
that. gathering low-cost funds from millions or billions of consumers and investing in risky assets. Where have we seen this movie before? How could this possibly go wrong? It's not considered deposit gathering, though, under the regs, would it be?
You know, I'm not a regulator, I'm not a lawmaker, but certainly a case could be made, and a case may be made. And again, this really just, right now we have, I think, a lot of really interesting academic conversation around a white paper. And the rubber will meet the road when transactions actually start occurring and the regulators take a closer look on how it's actually working. And then they'll decide whether or not it's acceptable. But I mean, there are clear paths to regulatory issues, right? Clear paths to regulatory issues that I think any legal professional who's familiar enough with this space can kind of see fairly obviously. It doesn't take a lot of digging.
Right. All right. Well, I promised that I wouldn't rehash last week's show, and I'm probably the Breaking Banks host that spends the least amount of time thinking and talking about things like distributed ledgers and blockchain and cryptocurrencies. So we will no doubt visit some of those more technical discussions in a future show. But this really could be a big deal. I mean, Facebook has nearly 2.4 billion monthly active users now. And in their white paper for Libra, they cite 1.7 billion adults globally remain outside the financial system with no access to a traditional bank. And even though 1 billion have a mobile phone and nearly half a billion have internet access, I mean, Rumi, will Libra actually help the unbanked and underbanked?
It's possible. I mean, you could say, did Facebook help improve communication amongst the same population? Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe some of them are able to network with each other in ways they haven't before, but at the same time, it's probably also created different types of social dynamics that you could say have been harmful to their societies and our societies broadly. So yeah, you can imagine, especially with developing countries where you don't have a stable digital currency, something like Libra would be attractive. You know, it's isolated from more volatile currencies like Bitcoin, as well as local government issued fiat currencies. And to the extent it can help things, not just with payments, but around, you know, issuing credit or with remittances, perhaps it can be very helpful. But I have to just step back a little bit. I never thought far enough on the points Dara was just making about the economic, I didn't want to call it value, but whatever you want, whatever the 27 companies are going to might be able to extract from this, it's a little bit frightening. It doesn't sit well with me at all. So I definitely think, you know, not only should regulators be looking more at this, but all of us have to be thinking whether this is indeed going to be a good thing for the world and for users. You can say, oh, it'll help the underbanked and the unbanked, but at what cost? I think there are a lot of costs here.
Go ahead, Dara.
So, Rumi, I couldn't agree more. So, JP, going back to your question about the unbanked and underbanked, you know, as an initial matter, right, you've got to get your Libras, you have to be able to turn over some actual currency. And then there is kind of the question about, like, well, how are we going to enable that? Is it going to necessarily have to be tied to another sort of traditional account? So query whether or not that hurdle in and of itself is already an obstacle for the unbanked or underbanked. But more importantly, I think that with the great ease of transacting on a platform like Facebook, I also think it's very fertile ground for people to use it for predatory purposes. And that's, to me, I think, just another layer of concern that is important, because every single victim of identity theft or a phishing scam, wire us this money. Now we're creating a situation where that those types of predatory scams can be executed very broadly, very efficiently, and without kind of proper oversight and management of that. It can be a very dangerous place for people to transact because of its ease. So those are all things that I think, especially for the unbanked and underbanked, is that we bring people into a system, you know, we've seen Facebook used for other predatory purposes before. And now we're adding, you know, financial transactions to that. So it's just something that we need to be aware of, because nobody wants that, right? Nobody wants this to be used as a platform to scam people. So, you know, from a legal perspective, I know that if I were a regulator, that would be something that I'd be thinking about immediately.
That's right. And this also, while we're assuming that 2.4 billion is referring to human individuals, as we know, just the incredible usage and increase of bots, right?
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
there's some 300,000 bots on Facebook Messenger alone. Let's say that there is some type of scan that then these bots replicate and replicate and replicate. Oh, it can get really frightening really fast.
Yeah, the ability to multiply. Well, and this gets back to what we were talking about earlier, which is the separation of the currency piece, right, the value store versus the ability to move money from point A to point B certainly isn't all that unique, or certainly not the first one to do that. And we look all the way back to M-Pesa in Africa and others. And Rumi, you've been investing and researching in this space a long time. What does something like Libra, what does it bring to the market that doesn't already exist?
I think, it just brings a little bit more of a feeling of maturation, especially amongst institutions who feel like, oh, this is the way it's going. There's no, I think people had recognized that the genie had been let out of the bottle before, just didn't quite understand the power of that genie. But very similar to, you know, JPM coin, you know, JP Morgan's coin, which was announced earlier. I mean, this is not necessarily new for institutions, but the more these corpo currencies come about, I think the more people realize that they have to have a bold and effective strategy in how to manage their businesses, assuming a digital currency network in the future.
Well, this is a big genie, and Reuters is reporting now there could be an instant payment system that's shared by all the banks in the Eurozone by the end of 2020, and that the Libra announcement is sparking them to move faster. I mean, will this be the push that's needed to make payment systems move closer to real time and closer to zero cost?
It's another push. But again, I don't think that these banks in the Eurozone were unaware of the issue prior to Libra, right? And so just simply the fact that it's out there may help them move faster. Not unlike, I remember when Ripple first came out as a potential competitor to Swift. Swift thought that, oh, we're going to have to move, quote unquote, faster now. But it is very hard to get large organizations to move fast, and especially if you're trying to corral all of them into one type of association or network or consortium. As we all know, working with larger financial institutions, you can say you want to move as fast as you want, but actually doing so still runs into all the bureaucratic trips and hurdles that come with, you know, a transformation of any kind.
Right. And that word you used, awareness, right? Yeah. Yes, they've been aware. But, you know, does the sheer scale of Facebook and their partners in this, you know, really cause somebody to move faster? And what about in the U.S.? I mean, we've been talking about faster payments and real-time payments for over 20 years now. We're still
not
there.
Right. I remember the Federal Reserve had that task force on faster payments a couple of years ago. And yeah, I mean, it's a challenge for any large institution, especially in the United States, when you have so many different regulatory regimes as well that you are trying to contend with, in addition to the 50 states, and they each have their own issues too, which I think could possibly be stymieing things. I am reminded of one institution, a financial institution, looking very early on the blockchain space, and they decided not to do so much anymore because they said, you know what, this is taking time. We've chosen not to be a leader. We'll be a fast follower. And I remember thinking to myself, who says you're going to be fast, right?
Well,
I mean,
I
think there's an assumption for a lot of these institutions where it's like, oh, you know, we'll follow, but we'll be fast when we do so. I have not seen fast anywhere, at least not in the United States, in the real-time payments field.
No, that's my famous line, right? That I usually say, well, you're half right. You're definitely a follower, but there's nothing fast about what you're doing.
Right. Right.
And the point is, right, if you're looking to get value out of something, you do have to be relatively fast. And Brian Solis talked about this on last week's show, too, the difference between innovating and iterating, right? Just picking up something that exists in the marketplace and adopting and iterating it is one thing, but that's not the same thing as innovating something where you're actually creating new value. And so I think that's one of the big questions in my mind about this, you know, how does this create new value? And, Dara, I'm curious. So I also think about, what does this look like in terms of registration and SEC compliance? You know, Kick Interactive is a Canadian social media messaging company. They were just sued by the SEC this month. They raised $100 million allegedly without registering the office, the offering. Do you think that this will impact Libra or anybody looking to create their own digital currency, crypto or otherwise?
Well, I think we started the show when I was talking about different rules depending on who you're talking to. The SEC
right.
is certainly one of those regulatory bodies that has its own view, particularly of ICOs. And really, it was about May of last year. That's when the U.S. and Canadian securities regulators essentially launched a coordinated international initiative focused on promoters and issuers of illegal and fraudulent cryptocurrencies and ICOs. The joint effort was called Operation Crypto Sweep, and it was coordinated by the North American Securities Administrators, the NASAA. I love the alphabet soup of all of the regulators.
Yes.
It had participation of more than 40 agencies, which resulted in like 47 enforcement actions. So the idea that the securities regulators are scrutinizing initial coin offerings to the highest degree is not news. There's been very, very coordinated regulatory enforcement effort in that regard. And I think a lot of the public result of that, you're seeing, I think we started seeing it in January of this year. And I think the Kick enforcement that you just mentioned is, going to be a continuation. And I think everyone should be prepared for more to come. And when clients come to me and talk about wanting to do a raise through a coin offering, there's usually lots and lots of questions that I have, but tread lightly is always my advice. And if it looks like a security and talks like a security and quacks like a security, it's a security. So follow the securities rules.
I'm sorry, I'll let you finish. I was just going to say there was a period of time there where, yes, some people seem to have believed those laws to have been suspended. And I couldn't open up email or LinkedIn message or Twitter without somebody offering me their ICO and explaining how that will be my get-rich-quick scheme. That does seem to have calmed down, but go ahead and finish your thought.
No, I mean, I think that that's exactly right. And part of it was, it wasn't necessarily of a suspension of the rules, but the SEC, the regulators, had been very quiet about it. It took a very long time for them to come out and make any sort of public statement or take a position whatsoever. And I think that their unwillingness or perhaps their lack of clarity, even intra-organizationally, about what their policy positions were on the subject, created opportunities for a lot of consumers to be taken advantage of. And in part, it's not because the securities laws just stopped applying or the rules stopped applying, but it was because our regulators, who companies consistently look to for guidance, were making no unofficial public statements. And it wasn't until, late 2018, where we started hearing a few squeaks, that everyone was like, oh, crap. We thought this was going to happen, and here it is. But in the meantime, there was months and months and months of companies kind of being like, well, no one says we couldn't do it, so you know, let's forge ahead. And now those companies are feeling the repercussions of that. So,
well, that was my point. It wasn't a suspension of the laws, but the people were behaving as if there were. And so I wonder, as we are now in another round of Bitcoin fever, and now, you know, maybe that's spreading to other types of cryptocurrencies and virtual currencies, I'm wondering how that will play itself out. And Rumi, again, you've been in this space a long time. How has your investment thesis, or the way that you frame up this space, how has that evolved? What's it look like today? And maybe how's that changed over the past few years?
Sure. You know, I'm with a group called Outlier Ventures, and we are a transatlantic investment platform. So I'm here in Chicago, but my partners are in Toronto and London and Amsterdam and soon to be Berlin. But we're focused on what we call convergence. And so it's not just blockchain in and of itself, right? But how does blockchain interact with other advancing technologies like artificial intelligence, like the Internet of Things? You know, when I first started off, when I was investing at the CME, we had different kind of buckets for different technologies. Now these are converging in very interesting and yet also frightening ways, because it's incredibly fast moving, especially if we think about devices. You know, I mentioned the bots on Facebook, but as you think about, you know, the trillions of things that are now going to be not just communicating with each other, but trading and transacting with each other, whether you're a self-driving car, are, you know, paying for your own electricity charge or what have you, the fintech implications, and then the corollary there, the payment, the digital payment, cryptocurrency implications there are very interesting. So that's what we are focusing our investments in. So it's not just about Bitcoin and trading systems as humans understand it today, but trying to think about how machines may be trading and interacting with each other in the future.
Well, I think convergence is a really interesting point, and I think it's, Darren, not to put words in your mouth, but I think that's part of what you're saying too, right? From the legal perspective, we've got a convergence of so many different aspects here that we have to pay attention to, and it's going to be hard, and it'll take a while to sort out, and it's the same thing around the technology. It's not any one of these things as a standalone. It's how do they all come together, and what new combinations do they create going forward? Any closing thoughts here before we wrap up another great discussion here on Breaking Banks?
Well, I think I would just say that, you know, the great thing about things like Facebook's white paper is that I do think it prompts a lot of really interesting and thought-provoking and in some ways academic discussions about what we're doing, why we're doing it, who we're trying to benefit, and how do we keep everyone safe in the process. And to me, those discussions in and of themselves always lead to bigger ideas, better ideas, and more thoughtfulness surrounding, you know, our financial systems. So at the very, very least, if the white paper has done nothing but get people thinking about new and better ways to do things, that's great. And if it ends up being the utopian money transfer tool that the whole world ended up needed, that'll be great too, as long as we can keep everyone safe in the process.
Wow, uncharacteristically optimistic for a lawyer. Can I say that?
Yes, you can say that.
I hope you're right. We try to think about it neither pessimistically nor optimistically, because I think the reality probably has a little bit of both, but it's certainly interesting and certainly has implications throughout financial services and even beyond. So Rumi Morales from Outlier Ventures, Dara Tarkowski from Actuate Law, thank you both for being back on the show. Appreciate both of your insights and perspectives, and appreciate you, the listener. As always, we appreciate your comments, suggestions, and questions. And you can find us every day on Twitter at BreakingBanks1. You can email us every day, too, if you'd like, at info@provoke.fm. And let us know if you're interested in sponsoring a show or a segment. Our sponsors make this show possible, and often they provide really great content as well. So if you just like the show and you want to support it in your own way, that's okay, too. You give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform. That really helps new listeners to find the show. And if you still want more, you can download this and any of our more than 300 shows from Breaking Banks, but also our sister shows like FinTech 5, Serial Entrepreneur, Breaking Banks Asia Pacific with Simon Spencer, and they're all available at provoke.fm. So that's it for this week, and we'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.